Ukraine's eastern city of Severodonetsk continues to be under heavy attack.
What we know today, so today's situation remains very difficult. Russian forces advanced a little bit. We know that now the fightings are basically happening in this industrial area.
Plus, as the conflict continues, does the war in Ukraine mirror other world events?
I'm afraid that we're sort of entering a Syria-type situation in which this conflict is just going to continue to grind along, I think probably in an unfavorable way for the Ukrainians.
And later in the program, the sale of a Nobel Prize for a Ukrainian charity brings home a staggering amount. Today is Tuesday, June 21st. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukraine reported heavy strikes Tuesday in the city of Severodonetsk as Russian forces continued in that area to push to gain full control of the eastern city. Anna Chernikova now joins us from Kyiv with more.
Very heavy fightings remain, but what we know that there are a couple of little towns next to Severodonetsk in Luhansk region that were actually captured by Russians, and now they're under Russian control. Ukrainian officials say that it's no strategic mean of the capturing of this town, so it's not going to give strategic advantage to the Russian forces. So if we come back to Severodonetsk, it is a very strategic point for sure for both sides, and this is why such, you know, heavy battles are happening. What we know today, so today's situation remains very difficult. Russian forces advanced a little bit. We know that now the fightings are basically happening in this industrial area as well. So we know that Ukrainian forces still control the territory of the Azov plant.
And Anna, that seems to mirror what took place earlier in Ukraine down in Mariupol with the Azovstal plant. I understand Russians were also using some artillery to try and advance their positions.
Very, very difficult situation, especially taking into consideration that there are a lot of civilians hiding at the Azov plant. So they all are basically under the Russian missile attacks, and they are under a big danger. We know that very heavy street fightings are continuing, and Ukrainian forces are trying to control as much buildings as they can. But again, in terms of artillery, of course, Russians have quite an advance.
Anna, thank you for that update. I also wanted to ask you about fighting elsewhere in the country, because I understand that, especially in the recent days, there has been an uptick in artillery and missile fighting, and that's something that President Volodymyr Zelensky alluded to earlier this week.
There is an increased risk of missile attacks across the country. So yesterday, Ukrainian government announced that Ukrainian society and Ukrainian citizens should be very careful in every region of Ukraine. They should be very careful because there is a scare of massive missile attack from the Black Sea. There is a high danger that Ukrainian cities and especially administrative centers and especially administrative buildings where the decisions are taken are under a risk. So today and next couple of days, Ukrainians are urged by the Ukrainian government to be very careful with air raid sirens and not to ignore air raid sirens, even if we are talking about Kyiv or Lviv, because the risk that missile strike could, you know, reach the towns is very high.
Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. For additional up-to-date information on what's taking place in Ukraine, visit our website at voanews.com/flashpoint. According to the United Nations estimates, some 2.5 million Ukrainians have crossed the Polish border and have gone back to Ukraine. Irina Martynenko is among those who returned to her native city of Sumy, which is located in the northeast. Anna Rice narrates this story.
Sumy resident Irina Martynenko has spent the past month learning how to shoot a rifle and administer first aid. Before the war, she helped people rent canoes and paddleboards and plan their Ukrainian vacations. In Sumy, this type of business is seasonal, so in December 2021, Martynenko went to Poland to earn some money. She was there when she learned Russia had invaded her native Ukraine.
No one could work or do anything. Everyone stared at their phones, walked around, and cried.
On the very first day of the war, Martynenko wanted to go back to Sumy, but her friends told her that the city had been blocked off and it was virtually impossible to come back.
I thought I would have to find something to do here, and we started to think how we could help Sumy.
Together with other Sumy residents in Warsaw, Martynenko started collecting medication, food items and clothes for people back home. In April, she decided to return.
I decided it was time to come back home. More so because all my relatives, my parents, my brother, they all stayed in Ukraine. My dog Tuся had been waiting for me especially patiently.
She headed back home with a new tattoo that said, "Good evening, we're from Ukraine." A phrase that Mykolaiv region governor Vitaly Kim uses to open his popular video reports and that has come to symbolize Ukrainian bravery and unity.
While I was in Warsaw, I didn't have a chance to buy such a t-shirt, so I went ahead and made a tattoo, and now I have a t-shirt that I can never take off. It feels very different compared to how it used to be. The city lives a different life, constant sounds of sirens, sounds of shelling. It's scary for everyone, but it's my home. This is where my life is.
Martynenko plans to start working in tourism again when it's possible. She also dreams of opening a nursery garden and doing landscape design, so her home will look as beautiful and green as it once was. For Alena Adaymenko in Sumy, Ukraine, Anna Rice, VOA News.
The United States State Department says that the U.S. remains concerned about steps Russia is taking to institutionalize control over sovereign Ukrainian territory. Maxim Mostakolov brings us this story.
The U.S. State Department says the latest events in the Kherson and the Zaporizhia regions of Ukraine currently occupied by Russia indicate Russia's intent to create another so-called People's Republic there. In the Kherson region, the Russian-appointed deputy head of the regional administration hasn't ruled out the possibility of a referendum like the one that preceded Crimea's annexation.
We'll announce later when some kind of vote or plebiscite is planned. But it won't be today and it won't be tomorrow, because our first task is to restore order in the Kherson region.
In recent weeks, Vladimir Putin signed a decree allowing residents of the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions to obtain Russian citizenship. By early morning on June 2nd, some 250 Kherson region residents applied for a Russian passport, according to the Russian-appointed Kherson administration. What's more, Russian SIM cards are now being sold in two occupied regions of Ukraine. And on May 31st, local Ukrainian authorities said internet and Ukrainian cell service had been cut off in occupied territories. American experts, however, say it's highly unlikely the two regions will join Russia.
None of these regions wanted to separate from Ukraine. These are Ukrainian territories. So if they tried to hold a referendum now, in light of the devastation that they caused, in light of the lack of any recognition from any other country for control over these territories, I think it'll be a joke.
Ukrainian TV channels stopped broadcasting in the occupied territories. Instead, residents can watch only Russian TV, which describes the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions as liberated. In addition, wheat from the previous year's harvest is being transported from the Kherson region to Russia. Local agrarians report raider attacks on their farms.
They bring their equipment, take the grain from the grain elevators, and take it to Crimea. From there, it goes to Sevastopol and gets sold there.
Many Ukrainian refugees who fled the country keep in touch with family and friends in Ukraine. Those who stay say they fear oppression from the occupiers, as well as a fake referendum that would make their region part of Russia. Men fear they will be enlisted and forced to fight their own people.
My close relatives are in Kherson, including my dad. Banks are not operating. It's impossible to withdraw money. Not salary, nor pension, nothing. Grocery stores are not working. Sometimes you can buy food directly from other people. But to be honest, everyone is afraid to leave their homes because there are many reports of people going missing.
Katerina Shkalyar lives in Zaporizhia. Lately, she's been volunteering, helping to bring humanitarian aid to the occupied area of the region.
They are not being bombed, but people are under occupation. Grocery prices have grown dramatically. Many people, of course, lost their jobs, the ones who didn't want to work with the occupiers. Many homes are being searched. Some men are taken away somewhere and held there for a few days. They are being asked to cooperate with Russian forces.
According to the New York Times, one-fifth of the Ukrainian territory is currently under Russian occupation. Maxim Moskalkov, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Russia continues pounding eastern Ukraine, and recently I spoke with Emily Holland, an assistant professor in the Russia Maritime Studies Institute at the U.S. Naval War College. Holland began our conversation by assessing Russia's advances.
I'm afraid that we're sort of entering a Syria-type situation in which this conflict is just going to continue to grind along, I think probably in an unfavorable way for the Ukrainians. You know, it's been pretty clear for the past several weeks and months now that, you know, Russia is just making very slow but steady progress, as you said, in eastern parts of Ukraine. And the momentum is certainly with them. You know, at the same time, so far, the West has been, you know, relatively committed to continuing to provide Ukraine with pretty heavy artillery and heavy weapons to keep fighting. So I don't think that will be enough for Ukraine to sort of turn the tides of the Russian momentum, but it may be enough to sort of keep the conflict grinding on for quite some time. And I'm afraid that that may be a pattern that we're settling into.
And in fact, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg reiterated over the weekend that he does anticipate the conflict lasting perhaps for some time. I want to turn a little bit to energy because the BBC has reported that China is now taking in more oil from Russia than it is from Saudi Arabia. And this is a markedly increase, but also comes after the United States and several other countries have put in place at least a partial ban on Russian hydrocarbons. And Europe is continuing to try and wean itself off Russian gas. I wanted to ask you what you thought the state of affairs was for the various sanctions and their impact on Russia.
Well, there's kind of two main issues. One is that, you know, Europe for a long time had been trying to move a transition towards renewables. So they had this desire to transition to renewables at the same time to move away from Russian energy. And that sort of tension really accelerated since the start of Russia's aggression in Ukraine. And at the same time, we have a background of just a tremendous global energy crisis. So, you know, what's happened as Europe has sort of reduced its consumption of Russian oil and natural gas. They have agreed to a full-out ban on the import of Russian oil by sea by the end of the year. So they've reduced their consumption of Russian energy. And, you know, Russia has been able to, as you mentioned, been able to divert a lot of those supplies towards China, India, and other markets at a discount. At the same time, you know, Europe is in a really serious energy crisis. Germany announced yesterday that they would have to restart coal-fired power plants rather than in order to reduce the amount of natural gas burn because they need to conserve natural gas so urgently ahead of the winter because there's such an impending energy crisis. So, you know, there's a real energy challenge. And, you know, on the one hand, sanctions have worked because we've reduced, in some senses, Europe's reliance on Russian gas. But at the same time, we haven't really reduced the revenues going to Russia because the price of energy is so high that what energy they do sell is basically making up for lost volumes. going to Europe, and then they are able to divert significant volumes towards Asia.
Speaking of Asia, diverting and diversifying, Beijing and Moscow are continuing to deepen their ties. And I wanted to ask you, what's your assessment of that?
Probably the one thing that, you know, certainly within the Beltway, people were concerned about prior to this conflict for many years was the potential, you know, closening of relations of China and Russia. And you know, this conflict is certainly accelerating, you know, more entanglements between China and Russia, at least in the energy sector. Remember, I mean, China is just going to be absorbing more and more, certainly oil and probably natural gas as Russia has time to sort of, you know, redraw and rebuild the infrastructure to export more of their hydrocarbons towards China. So that will be a challenge because Russia will still have a market for its hydrocarbons, admittedly at a major discount, high prices will kind of continue to plague the rest of the world.
And as things continue to move on, there's been some discussion of Ukraine fatigue. And I was wondering what you thought were the potential pitfalls of a long protracted conflict. You mentioned that, you know, this could be heading towards a Syria type situation. You know, what do you see as some of the major concerns moving forward?
Well, you know, the public has a very short attention span, as we all know. And certainly I'm very concerned about Ukraine fatigue, particularly as we're really on the precipice of a major economic crisis, particularly in Europe. I mean, it's very clear that recession is on the horizon. They have a serious impending energy crisis coming this winter. And the question remains, you know, will people be willing to sacrifice and keep up their sort of attention towards Ukraine when they are facing sort of serious domestic problems at home? And I am not confident that they will do so. And there may be sort of, you know, a diversion and demands for national governments to sort of reassert attention at home to sort of address what is going to be a very difficult coming years in the global economy, national economies, and particularly in European energy markets.
That was Emily Holland, an assistant professor at the U.S. Naval War College. Tamar Demuria, Chief Humanitarian Officer for CORES International, which is a non-governmental organization that works with communities to help them recover from natural and other disasters, recently spoke with me. Now, in part two of our conversation, we pick things up as she begins discussing the current humanitarian situation on the ground.
As someone who just recently traveled throughout Ukraine, you know, what's your assessment of the current humanitarian situation? Because since the war began, there have been pockets where there has been intense fighting and the delivery of medicine, food, water has been scarce. And then in cities like Lviv during the onset, where there were just an enormous amount of individuals, there was inadequate supply. So in your assessment, where do things stand now with people who are either there internally displaced or in the process of securing passage to a safer location in another country?
That's a great question. And I think the way I will try answering is those located in the east and even center of this of the country and further in the southern parts of Ukraine are definitely far more vulnerable in terms of accessing humanitarian aid as compared to the western part that housed and hosted a lot of those fleeing because people deemed that side of the country the safest to run to. However, it does not necessarily make those people that are now hosted by the Western Ukraine any different in terms of their needs. You still see pockets of medicine and definitely primary healthcare, as well as at times even secondary level healthcare provision being really acute towards the east and the south. These are the places that also impacted the medical personnel, not just the population. There is an increasing number of those that require not just the war-related wound treatment, but also follow up on chronic diseases, follow up on regular things such as vaccinations, some of the communicable diseases that are typically part of the normal life. So it hasn't really been normalized in terms of how the population is moving and where are they seeking these type of healthcare.
I want to jump in just a second. You mentioned the winter coming just around the corner.
Winterization is a huge concern for everyone, including the population itself, because they're not ready. They have no provision to prepare properly. This means ensure adequate heating. This means ensure adequate access to thermally insulated housing options. A lot of them are still living in those collective centers or the areas and buildings that are really not fit for purpose when you think of the winter and harsh winter, which gets really below zero, and it gets very rough in Ukraine. Access to water remains a challenge in some of the frontline areas where sanitation and water distribution and supply has been disrupted. Electricity is quite expensive, so the heating will also be a challenge. And more than anything, fuel has been a huge deficit across the country. So that really drives all the prices up and makes it a very expensive humanitarian catastrophe to respond to.
You know, one of the concerns that you brought up is the possibility of disease outbreaks. I know that the United Kingdom Defense Ministry has said that there is a potential for a cholera outbreak in Mariupol. But in terms of what you saw on your recent visit, what are some of the chief concerns either you, your organization, or have been reported to you by the folks that you spoke to about concerns for disease outbreak where there are populations either still in Ukraine or in transit?
Indeed, it's a very sensitive subject. And when you speak to the medical professionals in particular, they're all rolling eyes saying, we don't know how to cope with it. I had a chat with several of them in different parts of the country, including the secondary level hospital doctor and the chief doctor near Kharkiv. And basically, they unanimously say that the load has increased so much that they are unable to treat the patients and detect everything that might have been a normal communicable disease outbreak, not even an outbreak, disease concern or things that people go for on seasonal basis. This could be diarrheal diseases. These could be anti-respiratory diseases that are quite common across children, et cetera, et cetera. So they're all talking about the doctors being overwhelmed and unable to see every patient because they basically live in the hospitals. A lot of the medical personnel just brought those stretchers, the little cots, and they haven't seen their homes for months now. And that's how they're basically ensuring the shifts, especially in the eastern part of the country. This is pretty common. They're talking about increased number of patients, especially among the young population, the children that have fled towards the West, when now one primary healthcare doctor, like a family doctor, has to look after 2,000 children. So imagine, like, if you do simple math, in order to see every child, or at least vast majority of those children that have been added to the group that you already were assigned and it was quite stretched, you basically can't even attend to the basic needs unless it's several weeks of lapsed time until they come to you or you get to them.
That was Chorus International's Chief Humanitarian Officer, Tamara Demuria. And finally, a Nobel Peace Prize sold on Monday night, raising a staggering amount for a Ukrainian charity. AP correspondent Jennifer King rounds us out.
The Nobel Peace Prize auctioned off by Russian journalist Dmitry Muratov to raise money for Ukrainian child refugees sold Monday night for $103.5 million, shattering the old record for a Nobel. No word on who bought it, Muratov said in an interview after the auction. I was hoping that there was going to be an enormous amount of solidarity, but I was not expecting this to be such a huge amount. Muratov has said the proceeds will go directly to UNICEF in its efforts to help children displaced by the war in Ukraine. Just minutes after bidding ended, UNICEF told the auction house it had already received the funds. I'm Jennifer King.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day. Just be sure to visit voanews.com or follow us on social media at VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.